Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2014, edited by Jennifer Egan. Madame Bovary's Greyhound by Karen Russell. 1. First Love. They took walks to the beech grove at Banneville near the abandoned pavilion. Foxglove and gillyflowers, beige lichen growing in one thick crawling curtain around the socketed windows. Moths blinked wings at them, crescents of blue and red and tiger yellow like eyes caught in a net. Emma sat and poked at the grass with the skeletal end of her parasol as if she were trying to blind each blade. "Oh, why did I ever get married?" she moaned aloud, again and again. The greyhound whined with her, distressed by her distress. Sometimes, in a trader's fugue, the dog forgot to be unhappy and ran off to chase purple butterflies or murder shrew mice, or to piss a joyful stream onto the topiaries. But generally, if her mistress was crying, so was the puppy. Her name was Jolly, and she had been a gift from the young woman's husband, Dr. Charles Bovary. Emma wept harder as the year grew older and the temperature dropped, folding herself into the white monotony of trees, leaning further and further into the bare trunks. The dog would stand on her hind legs and lick at the snow that fused Emma's shoulders to the coarse wood, as if trying to loosen a hardening glue, and the whole forest would quiver and groan together in sympathy with the woman and her phantom lovers, and Jolly. At Banneville, the wind came directly from the sea and covered the couple in a blue salt call. The greyhound loved most when she and Emma were outside like this, bound by the membrane of a gale. Yet as sunset fell, Jolly became infected again by her woman's nameless terrors. Orange and red, they seemed to sweat out of the wood. The dog smelled nothing alarming, but love stripped her immunity to the internal weathers of Emma Bovary. The blood-red haze switched to a silvery blue light, and Emma shuddered all at once, as if in response to some thicketed danger. They returned to toasts along the highway. The greyhound was ignorant of many things. She had no idea, for example, that she was a greyhound. She didn't know that her breed had originated in southern Italy, an ancient pet in Pompeii, a favorite of the thin-nosed English lords and ladies, or that she was perceived to be affectionate, intelligent, and loyal. What she did know, with a whole-body thrill, was the music of her woman coming up the walk, the dizzying explosion of perfume as the door swung wide. She knew when her mistress was pleased with her, and that approval was the fulcrum of her happiness. "Viscount! Viscount!" Emma whimpered in her sleep. Rodolphe would come on the scene later, after the greyhound's flight, and poor Charlie B. never once featured in his wife's unconscious theater. Then Jolly would stand and pace stiff-legged through the cracked bowl of the cold room into which her mistress's dreams were leaking, peering with pricked ears into shadows. It was a strange accordion that linked the woman and the dog. Vaporous drafts caused their pink and gray bellies to clutch inward at the same instant. Moods blew from one mind to the other, delight and melancholy. In the blue atmosphere of the bedroom, the two were very nearly, but never quite, one creature. Even asleep, the little greyhound trailed after her madam through a weave of green stars and gas lamps along the boulevards of Paris. It was a conjured city that no native would recognize. Emma Bovary's head on the pillow, its architect. Her Paris was assembled from a guidebook with an out-of-date map, and from the novels of Balzac and Sand, and from her vividly disordered recollections of the Viscount's ball at La Vaubyessard, with its odor of dying flowers, burning flambeaux, and truffles. Many neighborhoods within the city's quivering boundaries, curiously enough, smelled identical to the Viscount's dining room. A rose and gold glow obscured the storefront windows, and the cathedral bells tolled continuously as they strolled past the same four landmarks: a tremulous bridge over the roaring Seine, a vanilla white dress shop, the vague facade of the opera house, overlaid in more gold light, and the crude stencil of a theater. All night they walked like that, companions in Emma's phantasmal labyrinth, suspended by her hopeful mists. And each dawn the dog would wake to the second Madame Bovary, the lightly snoring woman on the mattress, her eyes still hidden beneath a peacock sleep mask. Lumped in the coverlet, Charles's blocky legs tangled around her in an apprehensive pretzel, a doomed attempt to hold her in their marriage bed. 2. Change of heart. Is there any love as tireless as a dog's in search of its master? Whenever Emma was off shopping for nougat at the market, or visiting God in the churchyard, Jolly was stricken by the madness of her absence. The dog's futile hunt through the house turned her maniacal, cannibalistic. She scratched her fur until it became wet and dark. She paced the halls, pausing only to gnaw at her front paws. Félicité, the Bovary's frightened housekeeper, was forced to imprison her in a closet with a water dish. The dog's change of heart began in September, some weeks after Madame Bovary's return from La Vaubyessard, where she dervished around in another man's arms and given up forever on the project of loving Charles. It is tempting to conclude that Emma somehow transmitted her wanderlust to Jolly, but perhaps this is a sentimental impulse, a storyteller's desire to sink two flickering hearts. One day Emma's sense began to stabilize. Her fragrance became musty, ordinary, melting into the house's stale atmosphere until the woman was nearly invisible to the animal. Jolly licked almond talc from Emma's finger webbing. She bucked her head under the madam's hand a dozen times, waiting for the old passion to seize her, yet her brain was uninflamed. The hand had become generic pressure, damp heat. No joy snowed out of it as Emma mechanically stroked between Jolly's ears, her gold wedding band rubbing a raw spot into the fur, branding the dog with her distraction. There in the bedroom, together and alone, they watched the rain fall. By late February, at the same time Charles Bovary was dosing his young wife with valerian, the dog began refusing her mutton chops. Emma stopped checking her gaunt face in mirrors, let dead flies swim in the blue glass vases. The dog neglected to bark at her red-winged nemesis, the rooster. Emma quit playing the piano. The dog lost her zest for woodland homicide. Under glassy bathwater, Emma's bare body, as still and bright as quartz in a quarry, she let the hours fill her nostrils with the terrible serenity of a drowned woman. Her gossamer fingers circled her navel, seeking an escape. Fleas held wild circuses on Jolly's ass as she lay motionless before the fire for the duration of 2 enormous logs, unable to summon the energy to spin a hind leg in protest. Her ears collapsed against her skull. Charles rubbed his hand greedily between Emma's legs, and she swatted him off. Emma stroked the dog's neck, and Jolly went stiff, slid out of reach. Both woman and animal, according to the baffled Dr. Bovary, seemed bewitched by sadness. This strain of virulent misery, this falling out of love, caused different symptoms, unique disruptions in dogs and humans. The greyhound, for example, shat everywhere, whereas Emma shopped for fabrics in the town. On the 5th week of the dog's fall, Charles lifted the bedskirt and discovered the greyhound panting up at him with a dead-eyed calm. He'd been expecting to find his favorite tall socks, blue wool ineptly darned for him by Emma. He screamed, "Emma, what do you call your little bitch again? There's something the matter with it." "Jolly," Emma murmured from the mattress. And the dog, helplessly bound to her owner's voice, if not still in love with Madame Bovary, at least indentured to the ghost of her love, rose and licked the lady's bare feet. "Good girl," sighed Emma. The animal's dry tongue lolled out of her mouth. Inside her body, a foreboding was hardening into a fact. There was no halting the transformation of her devotion into a nothing. 3. What if? "If you do not stop making poop in the salon," Félicité growled at the puppy, "I will no longer feed you." In the 6th month of her life in Tosse, the dog lay glumly on the floor, her pink belly tippled orange by the grated flames, fatally bored. Emma entered the bedroom, and the animal lifted her head from between her tiny polished claws, let it drop again. "If only I could be you," Emma lamented. "There's no trouble or sorrow in your life." And she soothed the dog in a gurgling monotone as if she were addressing herself. Dr. Charles Bovary returned home, whistling after another successful day of leeches and bloodletting in the countryside, to a house of malcontent females. Emma was stacking a pyramid of green-gage plums. The little greyhound was licking her genitals. Soon the coarse, unchanging weave of the rug in Emma's bedroom became unbearable. The dog's mind filled with smells that had no origin, sounds that arose from no friction, unreal expanses. She closed her eyes and stepped cautiously through tall purple grass she'd never seen before in her life. She wondered if there might not have been some other way, through a different set of circumstances, of meeting another woman, and she tried to imagine those events that had not happened, that shadow life. Her owner might have been a bloody-smocked man, a baritone, a butcher with bags of bones always hidden in his pockets, or perhaps a child, the butcher's daughter, say, a pork-chop-scented girl who loved to throw sticks. Jolly had observed a flatulent malamute trailing his old man in the park, each animal besotted with the other. Blue poodles, inbred and fat, smugly certain of their woman's adoration. She'd seen a balding Pomeranian riding high in a toy wagon, doted on by the son of a king. Not all humans were like Emma Bovary. Out of habit, she howled her old courtship song at Emma's feet, and Emma reached down distractedly, gave the dog's ears a stiff brushing. She was seated before her bedroom vanity, cross-examining a pimple, very preoccupied, for at 4 o'clock Monsieur Rouault was coming for biscuits and judgment and jelly. A dog's love is forever. We expect infidelity from one another. We marvel at this one's ability to hold that one's interest for 50, 60 years. Perhaps some of us feel a secret contempt for monogamy even as we extol it, wishing parole for its weary participants. But dogs do not receive our sympathy or our suspicion. From dogs we presume an eternal adoration. In the strange case of Madame Bovary's greyhound, however, forever was a tensed muscle that began to shake. During the Christmas holidays she had daily seizures before the fireplace, chattering in the red light like a loose tooth. Loyalty was a posture she could no longer hold. Meanwhile, Emma had become pregnant. The Bovarys were preparing to move. On one of the last of her afternoons in Tosse, the dog ceased trembling and looked around. Beyond the cabbage rows, the green grasses waved endlessly away from her, beckoning her. She stretched her hind legs. A terrible itching spread through every molecule of her body, and the last threads of love slipped like a noose from her neck. Nothing owned her any more. Rolling, moaning, belly to the red sun, she dug her spine into the hill. "Oh, dear," mumbled the coachman, Monsieur Hivert, watching the dog from the yard. "Something seems to be attacking your greyhound, madame. Bees, I'd wager." "Jolly," chided Emma, embarrassed that a pet of hers should behave so poorly before the gentleman. "My goodness, you look possessed." 4. Freedom. On the way to Yonville, the greyhound wandered 50 yards from the Bovary stagecoach. Then she broke into a run. "Jolly!" Emma shrieked, uncorking a spray of champagne-yellow birds from the nearby poplars. "Stay!" Weightlessly, the dog entered the forest. "Stay! Stay! Stay!" the humans called after her, their directives like bullets missing their target. Her former mistress, the screaming woman, was a stranger, and the greyhound lunged forward, riding the shoals of her own green-flecked shadow. In the late afternoon she paused to drink water from large cups in the mossy roots of the unfamiliar trees. She was miles from her old life. Herons sailed over her head, their broad wings flat as palms, stroking her from scalp to tail at an immense distance, a remote benediction, and the dog's mind became empty and smooth. Skies rolled through her chest, her small rib cage and her iron-gray pelt enclosed a blue without limit. She was free. From a hilltop near a river bank, through an azure mist, she spotted two creatures with sizzling faces clawing into the water. Cats larger than any she'd ever seen, spear-shouldered and casually savage. Lynxes, a mated pair. Far north for this season. They were 3 times the size of the Bovary's barn cat, yet bore the same taunting anatomy. Analogous golden eyes, they feasted on some prey that looked of another world. Flat, thrashing lives they swallowed whole. Gazehound, huntress, the dog began to remember what she'd been before she was born. Winter was still raking its white talons across the forest. Spring was delayed that year. Fleshless fingers for tree branches. Not a blade or bud of green yet. The dog sought shelter, but shelter was only physical this far out, always inhuman. Nothing like the soft-bodied sanctuary she'd left behind. One night the greyhound was caught out in unknown territory, a cold valley many miles from the river. Stars appeared, and she felt a light sprinkling of panic. Now the owls were awake. Pale hunger came shining out of their beaks, looping above their flaming heads like ropes. In Toasts, their hooting had sounded like laughter in the trees. But here, with no bedroom rafters to protect her, she watched the boughs blow apart to reveal nocturnal eyes bulging from their recesses like lemons. She heard hollow mouths emitting strange songs. Death's rattle, old wind without home or origin, rode the frequencies above her. A concentrated darkness screeched and dove near her head, and then another, and then the dog began to run. Dawn was 6 hours away. She pushed from the valley floor toward higher ground, eventually finding a narrow fissure in the limestone cliffs. She trotted into the blackness like a small key entering a tall lock. Once inside, she was struck by a familiar smell, which confused and upset her. Backlit by the moon, her flat, pointed skull and tucked abdomen cast a hieroglyphic silhouette against the wavy wall. The greyhound spent the next few days exploring her new home. The soil here was like a great cold nose, wet, breathing, yielding. To eat, she had to hunt the vast network of hollows for red squirrels, voles. A spiderweb of bone and fur soon wove itself in the cave's shadows where she dragged her kills. When she'd lived with the Bovarys, in the early days of their courtship, Emma would let the puppy lick yellow yolks and golden sugar from the flat of a soft palm. Undeliberate, absolved of ruin intent, the dog continued to forget Madame Bovary. Gnawing on a femur near the river one afternoon, she bristled and turned. A deer's head was watching her thoughtfully from the silver rushes, separated by some incommunicable misfortune from its body. Its neck terminated in a chaos of crawling black flies, a spill of jeweled rot like boiling cranberries. Its tongue hung limp like a flag of surrender. Insects were eating an osseous cap between the buck's yellow ears, a white knob the diameter of a sand dollar. A low, bad feeling drove the dog away. 5. Regret. Regret, as experienced by the dog, was physical, kinetic. She turned in circles and doubled back, trying to uncover the scent of her home. She felt feverish. Some organ had never stopped its useless secretions, even without an Emma to provoke them. Hearth and leash, harsh voice, mutton chop, affectionate thump, she wanted all this again. There was a day when she passed near the town of Erin, a mere 9 miles from the Bovary's new residence in Yonville, and had the winds changed at that particular moment and carried a certain woman's lilac-scented sweat to her, this story might have had a very different ending. One midnight, just after the late April thaw, the dog woke to the sight of a large wolf standing in the cave mouth, nakedly weighing her as prey. And even under that crushing stare, she did not cower. Rather, she felt elevated, vibrating with some primitive species of admiration for this more pure being, solitary and holy itself. The wolf smelled with appetites that were ancient, straightforward, a stellar hunger that was satisfied nightly. An old wound sparkled under a brittle scabbard on its left shoulder, and a young boar's blood ran in torrents from its magnificent jaws. The greyhound's tail began to wag as if cabled to some current. A growl rose midway up her throat. The predator then turned away from her. Panting, it licked green slime from the cave wall, crunching the spires of tiny amber snails. The wolf glanced once more around the chasm before springing eastward. Dawn lumbered after through the pointed firs, unholstering the sun, unable to shoot, and the wind began to howl as if in lamentation, calling the beast back. Caught between two equally invalid ways of life, the greyhound whimpered herself toward sleep, unaware that in Yonville, Emma Bovary was drinking vinegar and black stockings and sobbing at the exact same pitch. Each had forgotten entirely about the other, yet they retained the same peculiar vacancies within their bodies and suffered the same dread-filled dreams. Love had returned, and it went spoiling through them with no outlet. In summer, the dog crossed a final frontier, eating the greasy liver of a murdered bear in the wide open. The big female had been gut-shot for sport by teenage brothers from Rouen, who'd been too terrified by the creature's drunken, hauntingly prolonged death throes to wait and watch her ebb out. In a last pitch, she'd crashed down a column of saplings, her muzzle frothing with red foam. The greyhound was no scavenger by nature, until nature made her one that afternoon. The three cubs squatted on a log like a felled totem and watched with grave maroon eyes, their orphan hearts pounding in unison. Still, it would be incorrect to claim that the greyhound was now feral or fully ingrained in these woods. As a fugitive, the dog was a passable success, but as a dog she was a blown spore, drifting everywhere and nowhere, unable to cure her need for a human or her terror at the insufficiency of her single body. "Our destinies are united now, aren't they?" whispered Rodolphe near the evaporating blue lake in a forest outside Yonville that might as well have been centuries distant. Crows deluged the sky. Emma sat on a rock, flushed red from the long ride, pushing damp wood chips around with her boot toe. The horses munched leaves in a chorus as Rodolphe lifted her skirts, the whole world rustling with hungers. In the cave, the dog had a strange dream. A long, lingering, indistinct cry came from one of the hills far beyond the forest. It mingled with Emma's silence like music. 6. A break. The dog shivered. She'd been shivering ceaselessly for how many days and nights now? All the magic of those early weeks had vanished, replaced by a dreary and devoted pain. Winter rose out of her own cavities. It shivered her. Troubled by the soreness that had entered her muscles, she trotted out of the cave and toward the muddy escarpment where she'd buried a cache of weasel bones. Rain had eroded the path, and in her eagerness to escape her own failing frame, the mute ruminations of her throbbing skeleton, the dog began to run at full bore. Then she was sliding on the mud, her claws scrabbling uselessly at the smooth surface. Unable to recover her balance, the greyhound tumbled into a ravine. An irony. She had broken her leg. All at once, Emma Bovary's final command came echoing through her. Stay. Sunset jumped above her, so very far above her twisted body, like a heart skipping beats. Blood ran in her eyes. The trees all around swam. She sank further into a soggy pile of dead leaves as the squealing voices of the blackflies rose in clouds. Elsewhere in the world, Rodolphe Boulanger sat at his writing desk under the impressive head of a trophy stag. Two fat candles were guttering down. He let their dying light flatter him into melancholy, a feeling quite literary. The note before him would end his love affair with Emma. How shall I sign it? Devotedly? No. Your friend? The moon, dark red and perfectly round, rose over the horizon. Deep in the trench, nostalgia swamped the greyhound in the form of olfactory hallucinations, snowflakes, rising yeast, scooped pumpkin flesh, shoe polish, horse-lathered leather, roasting venison, the explosion of a woman's perfume. She was dying. She buried her nose in the litter fall, stifling these visions until they ebbed and faded. It just so happened that a game warden was wandering in that part of the woods hours later, or maybe days. Something in the ravine caught his eye, low to the ground, a flash of unexpected silver. He dropped to his knees for a closer look. Oh, he gasped, callous hands parting the dead leaves. 7. The Two Bears. The greyhound lived with the game warden in a cottage at the edge of a town. He was not a particularly creative man, and he gave the dog his same name, Hubert. He treated her wounds as those of a human child, with poultices and bandages. She slept curled at the foot of his bed and woke each morning to the new green of a million spring buds erupting out of logs. Sky, blue, birdsong, mince chlorophyll. "Bonjour, Hubert," Hubert would call, sending himself into hysterics, and Hubert the dog would bound into his arms, and their love was like this— a joke that never grew old, and like this they passed 5 years. Early one December evening, Hubert accompanied Hubert to Yonville to say a prayer over the grave of his mother. The snow hid the tombstones, and only the most stalwart mourners came out for such a grim treasure hunt. Among them was Emma Bovary. From within her hood and crimson cloak, she noticed a shape darting between the snowflakes— a gray ghost trotting with his lips peeled back from black gums. "Oh," she cried, "how precious you are! Come here!" Her whistle crashed through the dog's chest, splintering into antipodal desires. "Run!" Stay! And it was here at the margin of instinct and rebellion that the dog encountered herself, felt a shimmering precursor to consciousness, the same stirring that lifted the iron hairs on her neck whenever she peered into mirrors or discovered a small, odorless dog inside a lake. Suddenly, impossibly, she did remember midnight in Tos, the walks through the ruined pavilion, crows at dusk, the tug of a leather leash, piano music, egg yolk in a perfumed hand, sad, impatient fingers scratching her ears. Something bubbled and broke inside the creature's heart. Emma was walking through the thick snow toward the oblivious game warden, one golden strand of hair loose and blowing in the twilight. "Oh, monsieur, I too once had a greyhound." She shut her eyes and sighed longingly, as if straining to call back not only the memory but the dog herself. And she very nearly succeeded. The greyhound's tail began helplessly to wag. Her name was Diada. And then the dog remembered, too, calloused hands brushing dead leaves from her fur, clearing the seams of black flies from her eyelid and nostrils, lifting her from the trench, their fine, sturdy bones clasped firmly around her belly as she flew through evening air, the rank, tuber-like scent enveloping her, the firelight in the eyes of her rescuer. Over his shoulders she glimpsed the shallow imprint of a dog's body in the mud. With a lovely amnesiac smile, Emma Bovary continued to fail to remember the name of her greyhound, and each soft sound she mouthed tugged the dog deeper into the past. It was an impossible moment, and the pain the animal experienced, staring from old rumpled Hubert to the absorbing, evanescing Emma, did feel very much like an axe falling through her snow-wet fur, splitting down the rail of her tingling spine, fatally dividing her. "My dog's name is Hubert," Hubert said to Madame Bovary, with his stupid frankness. He glanced fondly at little Hubert, attributing the greyhound's spasms in the cemetery drifts to the usual culprits, giddiness or fleas. Writhing in an agony, the dog rose to her feet. She closed the small, incredibly cold gulf of snow between herself and her master. "Sit," she then commanded herself, and she obeyed. And that story was Madame Bovary's Greyhound, written by Karen Russell, from The Best American Short Stories from the year 2014, edited by Jennifer Egan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Earth Song, Sky Spirit, edited by Clifford E. Trafser. Lead Horse by Diane Glancy. Rain blew through the screen. Natty stood in the open door, feeling the spray on her face. A tree in the backyard slammed its door, or maybe it was the room upstairs. The windows were still open. Her backyard bushes beat the ground. Back and forth, their fists pounded the grass. Let the curtains stand straight out. Let the storm stomp dance through her house. Rattle her plastic dress bags hanging on the door. Her shawl fringe and feathers. She watched the lid to the trash can fly across the yard like a war shield. She watched the leaves buck. "What's the battle out there?" Natty Joe said. He scratched his ear when Natty looked at him. Well, he wasn't what she hoped, but it was seeing all that potential in him. The wind wheezed through the weather stripping on the door. The whole yard shook, and it was the day of a family birthday. A relative Natty only wanted to send a card to, usually, but now she was on her way and the cousins were going to show up, and Natty had a sink full of dishes and a war in the yard and Joe's at the table. And he was starting to hum like electricity on the backyard wire. "It's a lot for one old woman," she thought. "It'll be over soon," Joe's comforted. "The relatives or the storm?" The trees raised and bowed their arms in exaggerated motions as if the cousins already pulled in the drive. But the relatives were out there under an underpass in their car, the old green Plymouth tossing a little in the gusts of wind, chewing them but not yet swallowing, jerking all the while with pleasure Natty could only imagine. She was making her corn chowder and cornbread and corn pudding. She should have said she'd meet them at Benny Bill's Ranchero. They could have a steak and dance, but the cousins didn't like that. She could outdo them any time. In fact, they couldn't do it at all. Yes, what a storm sash she was. But Joe's could still make her blush, and the cousins were coming, and she was supposed to kowtow and lick their flitters. The trees swept their arms. The storm shuddered over the house, horses' hooves running. Still, the rain torpedoed the house, just like Crooper and Boaz, the cousins, when they were boys, roughhousing upstairs, and you wanted to yell at them to stop. "You going to close that door, Nat?" "When I'm ready." She'd seen the highway once from a plane, the one time she flew. She'd felt the invisible cord that jerks a plane into the sky, a pull toy right up to the clouds where the highway and its cloverleaf looked like cucumber pickles in a jar, the tight highway loops like curls of onions. Maybe a spirit fell to the yard, flailing by the looks of it, the arms and legs struggling to get up and disappear before someone could look from her house and say, "Hey, there's a spirit out there." The splot between the elm and oak and the bushes beating it away. No, the wisteria didn't want any fallen spirit in their yard. Something was being swept out of the hunting grounds. The great spirit had his war stick out. The old hammock wind-danced. Then Joe's was at the door with her, kissing her jaw, rubbing his fingers across her back. Sometimes his hand went just under the fatty part of her hip. "Keep your hands on your own self," she said. Lightning cracked so loud, Natty closed the door. "It's too late by the time you hear it," Joe's told her. "Closing the door is like trying to get in the canoe once the flood started." He had his hairy hand on her stomach. "Joe's, I got the cousins coming for Wilhelmina's 50th birthday, though I think it should be her 70th. I'm trying to get myself geared for the smell of whorehound cough drops, mentholatum, and camphor." And Fedora, who was never anything but a chicken liver from the day they first sat her in the crib next to me. Chicken livers aren't bad. There was always some memory of them knocking in her head, trying to get out, but she wouldn't tell Joe's. Once the word was spoke, the object formed. In all, she was a lead horse, not the dull silver metal, lead, but the lead. She remembered once when she and her former husband were returning from her mother-in-law's house in the country. Natty figured she was driving her mother-in-law's old car when they finally had to take it away from her. And Natty's husband followed her on the narrow road at night in their car. It was harder to drive out front, yet he'd let her. Or rather, he waited to get out of the yard so she'd be first. He was teaching her already how to get along, teaching her already to lead. As if she didn't know. "What's bothering you, Natty?" "I was thinking." All of a sudden, Natty gulped. There was someone's face at the side window, not even knocking, not even hurrying to get in from the storm. She saw him as she turned to face Joe's. "Crooper!" She opened the door and jerked him in the house. The kitchen lights blinked off and on. The others staying in the car until the wind stopped whipping the trees. The cousins got their hair piled on top of their heads. They don't want the wind to bring it down. Natty could see them poking in the car out under the tree. Boaz's four-door, 20-year-old Plymouth wrapped to the ears with rain and leaves stuck to the windshield. Nothing would get through to them. Natty'd be hearing about every storm they got caught in for years. The 50-year rain. Rain dogs around the sun. They held their landing pattern for 15 minutes. "Now tell them to hang these newspapers over their heads and get in here. Whatever you don't want said, say it over and over until it's so common no one hears it anymore. That's the white man's way. Maybe Boaz just turned the Plymouth around and go back to Durant." But no, how she was glad she wasn't in the car with them. "Hu klumpta, eri kahume." The women screaming because the wind whizzed the newspapers from their heads, but their hair was still there, just listing a little to the side. A birch-bark canoe hanging over one ear. We brought a bag of pecans fresh out of the freezer, fresh as if we'd just picked them up. Crooper and Fedora and Boaz and Wilhelmina, jumping up and down in the kitchen, named with dignity and light. Why had they turned up such cocoons full of larvae? "Hey, how you world travelers today? Ooh-wee!" Mules, yessie, but she was a lead horse. You need seat belts for the run into Natty's house. Joe's whistled without knowing what he was doing, but he had a lead horse by the tail. He would light up and ride. Yezzo. Well, bless her up with real sunshine, but don't look like it's going to shine today. Rain's a blessing, Wilhelmina. I hope this isn't a token for the rest of my life. Yes, she was a bumpo brain for sure. The rainstorm sputtered over the house, seeming to let up at times, but it soon roared again. Natty's kitchen whummed down through her toes, as if falling from the sky. Here's the roof, smoke hole, she could see falling into it. The upstairs bedroom throw rugs, the white ceiling of the kitchen, the round table, moon-like, where she had to face her own kind. Which is the richest blessing an Indian can have. Family, she reminded herself daily. She should beat it on a deer hide bag and hang it above her stove, maybe with a woodland tribe floral pattern. It seemed to Natty her house opened like a flower, the back walk a stem, the kitchen, dining room, living room, and downstairs bedroom, the wide, round petals, the upstairs room buzzing like the Great Spirit with an attack of lumbago. Quietly, shoo, shoo, she had helped in the naming their lives. Want me to close them windows upstairs? No, things need rearranged, cleaned up. The cousins settled in, Fedora stirring Natty's chowder, Cooper at the kitchen table with a napkin on his lap, Boaz washing the dishes in the sink, Wilhelmina Kleenexed in the next room, crying over 50 years and the list of her hair. Natty'd hand them some quietude, just let them stay at her house long enough. Joe's. What, honey? He asked. The cousins looked at him. She was knifing him with jam spurts, keeping him fed, her toes probably curled in her shoes. A jet-fine landing, big, gawky wings stuck out like Boaz when he dive-bombed from the dresser to the bed. If she left Cooper alone in the house, he'd probably go through her underwear. Come on, Wilhelmina, get your birthday self in here. They sat at the table, Boaz, Fedora, Joe's, Cooper, Natty passing the cornbread and chowder, Wilhelmina dragging her wilted self to her chair. They spread in all six directions, north, south, east, west, down, up. The biggest thing that happens to Fedora's is when her button jar gets spilled, Cooper swallowed. Sometimes I go over and give it a nudge just so she has buttons to pick up. You seem touchy, Fedora. I thought Wilhelmina was the touchy one. I was out yesterday morning trying to chop wood. Boaz ran the honey across his cornbread. That old dead tree's been lying across my backyard now for 2 years. I chopped and chopped, but it wouldn't give. I'm not as touchy as Fedora. Can't we just eat and be quiet? Natty asked. Chew our cornbread, swallow, open our mouth and put in another bite. A cord of wood costs more than I can afford. No sense in buying it when I got a whole dead tree in my backyard. Boaz always drank his licorice tea with loud sips. I'm going to hire someone to chop that wood. The house rattled as they ate. Lightning bolts stroked the sky. I knew it would rain. I heard the blackbirds talking, but they didn't say we'd be stowed up under the underpass or hanging on with our teeth. Cooper excused himself. I've always been the youngest cousin. I guess I'm not used to being older, and Mother always insisted on us being nice to you, Natty, even when you came in the house like a horse. Of course, maybe someone from the church could come and cut that wood for me. Then I wouldn't have to pay. Your tea's always good, Natty. Boaz took two more gulps. And your cornbread. Some of the men have chainsaws. It wouldn't take them long. Better than me with the old axe. Never know how long the cold's setting in for this winter. Back in the old days, we had snowstorms. We don't have them so much anymore. I remember days when I was a boy, the road would be piled with snow and... What on earth are you talking about, Boaz? The rabbits were easy to catch because they couldn't hop in the snow. When you've seen so many winters, they all stay together like buttons in the jar. Wilhelmina blew her nose. Something hit the side of the house with a bang. Where's Cooper? I don't want him looking in any windows around here. Just the trash blowing around. Joe's went to look. Now, if I'd saved my money, I could buy a chainsaw. Then I'd have firewood on my back porch, and I wouldn't have to worry about keeping warm or cooking. Maybe the Hanshee's boy would cut it for me. But everyone's busy. Too bad they can't say, Boaz, could I come and cut that wood for you, because we might just have snow, or a hard, cold spell one of these days, and we don't want you to be without firewood, or worse, that tree could fall on your house and smash it in two, or worse. Boaz, this is my birthday, and I say, shut up! Drag it all out, like pulling string from the drawer your mother saved until she yelled at us and we had to roll it back into a ball. What do you want, Boaz, for us to get in the Plymouth right this minute and cut your wood? No, by shucks, I'm just talking. Then hang it up, Natty said. Empty dress bags, all of them. No one ever know you carry a tomahawk in your heart, your witchery sticking straight pins in that pincushion on Fedora's wrist. You want blood? No coup sticks for her. No sirio. If I eat Natty's supper, Fedora'll have to let out my pants with a gusset. Gusset. I don't have words for the things I want to say, and the words I do have don't fit the things I can say with them. Krupper, get in here! I think people are wearing their old clothing, not buying new. Fedora scraped the bowl of corn chowder. Just think of all the words there are to say whatever you need to say. How I wish I knew more words. I feel sometimes there's an exact word for each tiny detail, if only I knew it. How about that ambivalent feeling when I see you, Natty? Wilhelmina supposed. I'm delighted, yet some remote, inexplicable dread gnaws in the back of my head. And I want a word for the last of the afternoon, just before it turns into evening. It's called dusk, Fedora. Not dusk. No, that's too late. That's a dead afternoon. But I want the name for an old, old afternoon, full of stars just before they shine, but are geared up. The word for after a storm when it's all wet and dripping and quiet. The storm ain't over yet. I can still hear rain yawl against the roof. Let's get it out. Let's pull the string until there's none left in the drawer. Then who's the man been looking in windows around Durant? He wears a sock on his head. A what? Don't even think it. Maybe we should listen to the radio. Wilhelmina won't let us turn it on, ever since she was jilted by a radio repairman. Krupper wears garters for his socks. I saw them on his dresser. His socks by his chair had tops so stretched he could have fit them on his head. How do you get the tops of your socks so big? There was a sudden rush of wind, then momentary quiet. The sky's kind of greenish. They looked at one another. It's late in the year for tornadoes. Krupper tried to excuse himself again. Thought he'd go out and keep a rightful eye on things. Sit down, Krupper. Fedora poked the candles into the corn pudding, nervous as a crooked seam. Boaz sang, Happy Birthday! Wilhelmina blew her nose. The light bulbs in the kitchen quivered again. There was a louder rush of wind. Wilhelmina screamed. Something upstairs fell over. For a moment there was a pinkish fizz of light like birthday candles. Even Boaz yelled out with a bark. Natty seemed lifted from the house, up past the white ceiling, the throw rugs in the upstairs bedroom, the roof, smoke hole. She was Dorothy in her red moccasins, even Toto, barking. No, that was Boaz. She was floating over Oklahoma, above the cucumber-pickled highways and clover leaves, heading north, speaking different tongues. What the diz? Out into the great black sky, spirits flapping like spurts of light to keep her right side up. The cousins talking anyway. And we know who the star is. Wilhelmina, our birthday girl. What the flux going on? Was Natty the only one seeing spirits? Were the cousins shucking raisins into their corn pudding, drinking coffee and licorice tea? Had someone hit her in the head with the pan of cornbread when they cleared the table? I think that was the storm's last gasp. I couldn't sleep otherwise. I have to have silence. You could never sleep in the room with Natty. She snores. They all looked at Joe's. Maybe she had died. Hadn't Natty passed a line of cars on a curve on old Highway 40 long ago? Traffic was slow and she got impatient and pulled out. The boy she was with drank too much. She was driving, and she didn't have sense to stay in line, but passed. The lead horse out there. She made it, pulling back with an inch to spare. Why was she saved? Just making it around the cars? Maybe her own death just now caught up with her. Maybe there was someone in that oncoming car the Great Spirit didn't want dead at the moment. So she married, had a child, drove both of them away. Natty couldn't say what her life had meant. No, she hadn't died. The cousins wouldn't come to see her if she wasn't there. We're searching for truth right here with us in the universe. I know what I'm doing at any given moment. It's the overall purpose of life that's evaded me. Right, fine. Was Natty really there in the room with her cousins? Who can enjoy their birthday with Crooper sitting there, his face down to his ankles? Just because we won't let him go outside. Not without one of us going with him. After the drive from Durant, a man needs to get out and walk. What? Natty flummed. You'd walk straight to someone's back window. What comes over you, Crooper? I don't know. I'm taking a walk, and before I know it, I feel someone's window glass against my nose, and they're in their house screaming that someone's at the window. Natty felt her hands. She wanted the cousins to be quiet. She wanted to ask if they could see her. She had heard the horse hooves of the storm. Maybe she was still out there, over the house. She wanted her cousins to say something to her so she'd know she was in her kitchen and not lifted off the migration trail of the earth. She looked at Joe's and her cousins around the table. She saw she wasn't the lead horse without the others to follow. Yes, just look at them. Head, tail, 4 feet. It took all 6. Yow! North, south, east, west, earth, sky. Natty was in the spirit. Boaz opened his mouth again to say something about chopping wood, or Natty shuddered with impatience and spoke to her cousins. The storm's a horse over us, a wreath of flowering houses around its ears, a braided mane, its hooves tromping through the yard, lead horse of lead horses. Yes, Natty'd seen a spirit of which they were only part. The cousins and Joes stared at her. Natty'd been proud, thinking she was the whole show, but now she had a vision from the spirit world. She'd been given the birthday gift. She shared it with the others. Boaz cleared his throat with a whorehound cough drop. Crooper and Fedora sat looking at one another around the kitchen table. Wilhelmina still stared at her. Joe stood at the door. Natty wanted to feel his hand on her stomach. She got up and went to him. The trees dripped the last of their rain into the grass. Nothing we can't put back together, he told her, except maybe the upstairs. If a spirit had fallen in the yard, by jolly, it'd gotten up and gone on. Maybe it'd been Natty's pride running from the horse. She felt the damp curtain of the breeze on her face. She looked again to see if the cousins were still staring. But Wilhelmina was recouping. The others were starting to stir from their chairs at the kitchen table, rising almost as children, after the spirit storm that, yes, left them touched for a moment with some pure likeness. And that story was Lead Horse by Diane Glancy from Earth Song Sky Spirit, edited by Clifford E. Trafser. The next story is from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. Sunday in the Park by Bell Kaufman. It was still warm in the late afternoon sun, and the city noises came muffled through the trees in the park. She put her book down on the bench, removed her sunglasses, and sighed contentedly. Morton was reading the Times Magazine section, one arm flung around her shoulder. Their 3-year-old son, Larry, was playing in the sandbox. A faint breeze fanned her hair softly against her cheek. It was 5:30 of a Sunday afternoon, and the small playground, tucked away in a corner of the park, was all but deserted. The swings and seesaws stood motionless and abandoned. The slides were empty, and only in the sandbox 2 little boys squatted diligently side by side. How good this is, she thought, and almost smiled at her sense of well-being. They must go out in the sun more often. Morton was so city pale, cooped up all week inside the gray factory-like university. She squeezed his arm affectionately and glanced at Larry, delighting in the pointed little face frowning in concentration over the tunnel he was digging. The other boy suddenly stood up and, with a quick, deliberate swing of his chubby arm, threw a spadeful of sand at Larry. It just missed his head. Larry continued digging. The boy remained standing, shovel raised, stolid and impassive. No, no, little boy. She shook her finger at him, her eyes searching for the child's mother or nurse. We mustn't throw sand. It may get in someone's eyes and hurt. We must play nicely in the nice sandbox. The boy looked at her in unblinking expectancy. He was about Larry's age, but perhaps 10 pounds heavier, a husky little boy with none of Larry's quickness and sensitivity in his face. Where was his mother? The only other people left in the playground were two women and a little girl on roller skates leaving now through the gate, and a man on a bench a few feet away. He was a big man, and he seemed to be taking up the whole bench as he held the Sunday comics close to his face. She supposed he was the child's father. He did not look up from his comics, but spat once deftly out of the corner of his mouth. She turned her eyes away. At that moment, as swiftly as before, the fat little boy threw another spadeful of sand at Larry. This time some of it landed on his hair and forehead. Larry looked up at his mother, his mouth tentative. Her expression would tell him whether to cry or not. Her first instinct was to rush to her son, brush the sand out of his hair, and punish the other child, but she controlled it. She always said that she wanted Larry to learn to fight his own battles. "Don't do that, little boy," she said sharply, leaning forward on the bench. "You mustn't throw sand." The man on the bench moved his mouth as if to spit again, but instead he spoke. He did not look at her, but at the boy only. "You go right ahead, Joe," he said loudly. "Throw all you want. This here is a public sandbox." She felt a sudden weakness in her knees as she glanced at Morton. He had become aware of what was happening. He put his Times down carefully on his lap and turned his fine, lean face toward the man, smiling the shy, apologetic smile he might have offered a student in pointing out an error in his thinking. When he spoke to the man, it was with his usual reasonableness. "You're quite right," he said pleasantly, "but just because this is a public place..." The man lowered his funnies and looked at Morton. He looked at him from head to foot, slowly and deliberately. "Yeah?" His insolent voice was edged with menace. "My kid's got just as good right here as yours, and if he feels like throwing sand, he'll throw it. And if you don't like it, you can take your kid the hell out of here." The children were listening, their eyes and mouths wide open, their spades forgotten in small fists. She noticed the muscle in Morton's jaw tighten. He was rarely angry. He seldom lost his temper. She was suffused with a tenderness for her husband and an impotent rage against the man for involving him in a situation so alien and so distasteful to him. "Now, just a minute," Morton said courteously. "You must realize..." "Aw, shut up," said the man. Her heart began to pound. Morton half rose. The Times slid to the ground. Slowly the other man stood up. He took a couple of steps toward Morton, then stopped. He flexed his great arms, waiting. She pressed her trembling knees together. Would there be violence? Fighting? How dreadful! How incredible! She must do something. Stop them. Call for help. She wanted to put her hand on her husband's sleeve, to pull him down, but for some reason she didn't. Morton adjusted his glasses. He was very pale. "This is ridiculous," he said unevenly. "I must ask you." "Oh, yeah," said the man. He stood with his legs spread apart, rocking a little, looking at Morton with utter scorn. "You and who else?" For a moment the two men looked at each other nakedly. Then Morton turned his back on the man and said quietly, "Come on, let's get out of here." He walked awkwardly, almost limping with self-consciousness, to the sandbox. He stooped and lifted Larry and his shovel out. At once Larry came to life. His face lost its rapt expression, and he began to kick and cry. "I don't want to go home. I want to play better. I don't want any supper. I don't like supper." It became a chant as they walked, pulling their child between them, his feet dragging on the ground. In order to get to the exit gate, they had to pass the bench where the man sat sprawling again. She was careful not to look at him. With all the dignity she could summon, she pulled Larry's sandy, perspiring little hand, while Morton pulled the other. Slowly and with head high, she walked with her husband and child out of the playground. Her first feelings was one of relief that a fight had been avoided, that no one was hurt. Yet beneath it there was a layer of something else, something heavy and inescapable. She sensed that it was more than just an unpleasant incident, more than defeat of reason by force. She felt dimly it had something to do with her and Morton, something acutely personal, familiar, and important. Suddenly Morton spoke. "It wouldn't have proved anything." "What?" she asked. "A fight. It wouldn't have proved anything beyond the fact that he's bigger than I am." "Of course," she said. "The only possible outcome," he continued reasonably, "would have been what? My glasses broken, perhaps a tooth or two replaced, a couple of days' work missed, and for what? For justice? For truth?" "Of course," she repeated. She quickened her step. She wanted only to get home and to busy herself with her familiar tasks. Perhaps then the feeling, glued like heavy plaster on her heart, would be gone. Of all the stupid, despicable bullies, she thought, pulling harder on Larry's hand. The child was still crying. Always before, she had felt a tender pity for his defenseless little body, the frail arms, the narrow shoulders with sharp wing-like shoulder blades, the thin and unsure legs, but now her mouth tightened in resentment. "Stop crying," she said sharply. "I'm ashamed of you." She felt as if all three of them were tracking mud along the street. The child cried louder. If there had been an issue involved, she thought, if there had been something to fight for, but what else could he possibly have done? Allow himself to be beaten? Attempt to educate the man? Call a policeman? "Officer, there's a man in the park who won't stop his child from throwing sand on mine." The whole thing was as silly as that and not worth thinking about. "Can't you keep him quiet, for Pete's sake?" Morton asked irritably. "What do you suppose I've been trying to do?" she said. Larry pulled back, dragging his feet. "If you can't discipline this child, I will," Morton snapped, making a move toward the boy. But her voice stopped him. She was shocked to hear it, thin and cold and penetrating with contempt. "Indeed?" she heard herself say. "You and who else?" And that story was Sunday in the Park by Bell Kaufman, from Sudden Fiction, American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.